A few days after the end of the war in Europe, in May 1945, a death occurred at the Radcliffe Infirmary here in Oxford. The dead man's name was Charles Williams. His mortal remains lie in St. Cross Churchyard, a stone's throw, yes, I think stone's throw is the right word, a stone's throw, you might say, from the English faculty building. At the time of his death, he was a few months short of his 60th birthday. Williams had arrived in Oxford very soon after the outbreak of war in September 1939 as a member of the London office of the Oxford University Press, which had been evacuated from its premises close to St. Paul's Cathedral in the heart of the city. The 5 years he spent here were among the most rewarding of his somewhat straitened life. He was revered by C.S. Lewis, who introduced him to the Inklings, a blessing which I rather wish he had been spared. He was not a scholar of the caliber of Lewis or Tolkien, yet in my judgment he remains a more significant writer than either of them, beyond question, a more acute critic of contemporary literature than Lewis. Without a degree when he arrived, he was made an honorary MA and gave memorable lectures for the depleted and foreshortened wartime English school. He had already edited Milton and Gerard Hopkins for the OUP. Now he excited the undergraduates with his lectures on chastity in the Ludlow Mask. And they flocked to hear him. It amazes me now to realize that when I came up in October 1950, Williams had been dead for a mere 5 years, scarcely more distant then than I am now from my inaugural lecture in this auditorium in December 2010. But at 18, 5 years comprises a third to a quarter of one's entire lifetime. At 83, it's a mere 16th, or a little less. This lecture is not about Williams precisely, but his critical presence may be said to infuse it. Oxford University Press has on the stocks a critical biography of Williams by Greville Lindorp, which will supersede anything that I have to say. The book by Williams which chiefly concerns me here is, I admit, the least satisfactory of his three major collections on English poetry, collections of critical writing on English poetry. The best of them, The English Poetic Mind, Oxford at the Clarendon Press, 1932, I would unhesitatingly recommend to current students of Shakespeare, Milton, and Wordsworth, its 83 years notwithstanding. His other book, Poetry at Present, 1930, is uneven, yet contains one of the most perceptive observations on the workings of poetry that he ever made. Let us first inquire what flotsam, what detritus, the title phrase, Poetry at Present, carried in its wake 15 years short of a century ago. Williams then considered as contemporary the poetry of Thomas Hardy, Robert Bridges, A.E. Housman, Rudyard Kipling, W.B. Yeats, W.H. Davis, Walter Delamere, G.K. Chesterton, John Masefield, Ralph Hodgson, Wilfred Gibson, Lassell's Abercrombie, T.S. Eliot, Edith Osbert and Sir Cheverel Sitwell, Robert Graves, Edmund Blunden. Williams's book contains a chapter on each, though the three Sitwell siblings have to share a single chapter. Some would say that is over generous, but I would not agree. Every one of these 18 names means something to me, because I am an old and jealous lover of the art and an old and malign opponent of what I decide is cultural stupidity in high places. 10 of Williams's poets ought to be instantly recognized and dated to within a couple of decades by any second or third year undergraduate member of the English faculty who may be contemplating a baccalaureate dissertation on some aspect or aspects of 20th century British poetry. Who was Lassells Abercrombie, you may ask? Lassells Abercrombie was prominent among contributors to Eddie Marsh's immensely popular sequence of anthologies, Georgian Poetry, which were annual productions around the time of the Great War, to appear in which was considered a grand accolade by aspiring poets. Lassells Abercrombie was revered by Isaac Rosenberg. Get hold of Vivian Noakes's splendid scholarly edition, Isaac Rosenberg, which originated in doctoral research conducted under the supervision of John Stallworthy. Get hold of that book, published by Oxford University Press in 2008 in their 21st Century Oxford Authors series. Turn immediately to the subject index in that book. A for Abercrombie, there he is, at the head of column one, with 18 entries. Next, consider the subdivisions of these entries. IR comments on LA's work, 5 citations. LA comments on IR's work, 4 citations. IR letters to LA, pages 292, 297. Marsh sends IR's work to LA, 6 entries. In late July 1916, Private I. Rosenberg, address deleted by censor, wrote to an acquaintance, "Abercrombie's Hymn to Love is, I think, the great thing of modern times, and far above anything else of his I know." 6 months earlier, Rosenberg had reported to a friend Abercrombie's letter to him, Isaac Rosenberg, in which the older man had said, "What I like most in your songs is your ability to make the concealed poetic power in words come flashing out. Some of your phrases are remarkable. What I like most in your songs is your ability to make the concealed poetic power in words come flashing out. Some of your phrases are remarkable. No one who writes poetry would help envying some of them." Abercrombie was no fool. He could sense weird excellence when he encountered it. And what a joy it must have been for the virtually unknown Rosenberg to receive such praise from so established a figure whom he so devoutly admired. A century on, and the name of Lassells Abercrombie is heard from time to time, albeit rarely, mentioned with respect because he had spoken well of an obscure and penniless young Jew from London's East End, who 97 years after his death is belatedly established as a major 20th century figure of British poetry. In 1948, a working class boy at school in Worcestershire, who coincidentally bore my enviably distinguished name, already knew a few Rosenberg poems, but back then, Rosenberg was a marginalized figure, and I was odd enough to be caught reading poetry during half-time in the stands at West Bromwich Albion. Characteristically, in the 1930s, F.R. Leavis's periodical Scrutiny, dedicated to setting the critical cat among the cultural pigeons, praised him highly. It was, however, a major work of criticism published in 1972 that really began the work of focusing Rosenberg and his poetry and poetic drama and to affront our cultural short-sightedness with his manifest presence. I am referring, of course, to John Silkin's Out of Battle, the Poetry of the Great War, London, Oxford University Press, 1972, after 43 years, still by far the best critical account of British poetry of that time, and by intelligent implication and extrapolation of the present time also, because that, after all, is what the finest historical criticism does. It does not merely explain what poetry was in, say, the period of the Cromwellian Republican Protectorate. It also tells you by inference and conference what poetry is in 1958 or 1999 or 2015. Too many with whom I've been professionally required to discuss poetry in the course of the past 60 years appear to believe that when we take up this topic, we are encountering a simple narrative, and that it is our task simply to protract this simple narrative into further generations. What confronts us, in fact, is not a simple narrative, but a vortex of sorts, part force field, part force field with its main drive broken, what I will call impaction. Now, vortex and force field are terms that I've employed in previous lectures. Vortex, a characteristic term of the sculptor Henri Gaudier, 1891-1915, also employed by Ezra Pound, 1885-1972, Percy Wyndham Lewis, 1882-1956, and W.B. Yeats, 1865-1939, is a word of 17th century origin and 20th century modification. Originally, it referred to a supposed rotatory movement of cosmic matter round a center or axis, regarded as accounting for the origin or phenomena of the terrestrial and other systems, a body of such matter rapidly carried round in a continuous whirl, OED 1989. On the modernist mutation of the word, it needs to be said, the 1989 OED is at first sight useless. Don't look it up under vortex. Look it up under vorticism, and you will find there Pound's crucial definition of vortex. The image is not an idea. The image is not an idea. It is a radiant node or cluster. It is what I can call a vortex from which ideas are constantly rushing. And from this necessity came the name vorticism. A force field doesn't have an entry in my 1989 OED, though force feed does. If, however, we look up field and licky index finger it through to the bottom of column 6, sense 17A, physics, fields of force is first revealed in a sentence dating from 1850, an entry in the diary of the great chemist and physicist Michael Faraday. When the opposed bodies are on opposite sides of the axis, magnetic, Then the figured forms would give fields of force in which the lines of magnetic power would vary. I could recommend the whole of the 17A entry to any junior historian of modernist poetics. It reveals both the acumen and pathos of such a position. Acumen because it shows how intelligent minds seek to make definable and debatable what is in fact no more than an intuition as to how language may be imagined to work. Pathos, because it demonstrates the desire of practitioners of an art to find a style of description which may persuade themselves and others that what we are in fact dealing with is not a disreputable art, but a dignified science. I should add here that, to the best of my recollection, my own discovery that the term had possibilities was owed not in this case to the OED, but to Anscombe's English translation of Wittgenstein's Philosophische Untersuchungen, Philosophical Investigations, originally published in 1953. The four pages, 186, 186E, 187, 187E, of the 2001 edition of Philosophical Investigations have always seemed to me to possess a wonderful richness. Es ist eben nicht mit jenem ersten Urteil abgetan, denn es ist das Feld eines Wortes, was entscheidet. That first judgment is not the end of the matter, for it is the field of force of a word that is decisive. That first judgment is not the end of the matter, for it is the field of force of a word that is decisive. You'll have noticed, even so, that Wittgenstein's German is simply Feldeines Wortes. The field of force of a word is Anscombe's translation. Perhaps, since this is a valedictory lecture, I may be permitted the extravagance of suggesting that should any future undergraduate be so ill-advised as to wish to produce an essay on my critical tenets and practice, she must be aware that for me, the concept of the linguistic force field has the twisted vitality of sacred scripture in the mind of a religious maniac. Whether the concept of the linguistic force field merits the importance which I attach to it is the crucial question to which the essayist will be obliged to respond. I cannot otherwise see how her discussion will avoid conveying an effect of conceptual inertia. Now, the term inertia returns me to the figure of Charles Williams, with whom I began, and to his book Poetry at Present, published in 1930. It may seem to you, given my remarks about his inclusion of such figures as W.H. Davis and Wilfred Gibson, and his exclusion of Owen Rosenberg, and except for a passing mention, Edward Thomas, that I am about to indict him for gross negligence, but that is far from my intention. There are admirable things in the chapter on Abercrombie, as this, for instance. This poetry, he means Abercrombie's, this poetry demands close reading and close thought. And such poetry cannot be lightly, or indeed at all, be re-expressed in prose. Matthew Arnold's claim that the loftiest function of poetry is the application of ideas to life, true as far as it goes, fails only to note that this application of that life to ours is something profounder than the deduction of a moral or philosophical idea. It is the entering in through the senses and through the mind of another existence. The difference, so far as it can be briefly indicated, between the critical language of Charles Williams and the critical language of Ezra Pound or of Percy Wyndham Lewis is that even though he is pointing to the critical limitations of Arnold, his somewhat weighty mode of word choice and syntax strikes us as being within the Arnold tradition, whereas the critical idioms of Pound and Lewis do not. Even so, to put it somewhat sweepingly, their sources are as early to mid-Victorian as are his. But where they derive from Faraday and the electromagneticists, he derives from the amalgamated precedents of literae humaniores. I said a little while back that Poetry at Present, 1930, Williams's 1930 book, Poetry at Present, while more erratic than the English Poetic Mind, his book of 1932, nonetheless contained one of Williams's most brilliant critical aperçus. Here it is. It's part of a generalization, and of course, generalizations can be wild and unjust. But it is a generalization concerning not all, but a significant amount of poetry at present, understanding at present to be 1930. This is what he said. "These poets have as much of our ordinary working day brains as the rest of us. Their meditations are as subtle, their philosophies no less, but no more surely based. They remark what we do and turn it into rhythm. But, the faculty of compressing such meaning into a phrase is denied to them. We have to cover as much ground in their verse as in our own thoughts, and consequently, we tire as soon. We have to cover as much ground in their verse as in our own thoughts, and consequently, we tire as soon." When I read this brief passage, much too recently to benefit the bulk of my own oeuvre, he says ingratiatingly, I felt, as one occasionally does, as though the sphere of my critical cognizance had spun more rapidly for an instant and then settled back permanently onto a slightly different angle of axis. Let me become a little aggressive towards you on this topic by the easy expedient of introducing the name of Larkin. Philip Larkin, The Complete Poems, edited by Archie Burnett, London, Faber and Faber, 2012, contains fine poems. Fine poems. And poems that are average. And poems that are even below average. His work is rated so highly across the literary board because a large consensus has been persuaded by critical opinion that certain mediocre poems are outstanding. The truly outstanding poems by Larkin may have gone largely unheeded, may even now be scarcely known. Here is a poem generally approved of by the lobbyists, but not, in my judgment, a masterpiece of our time. Church going. Once I'm sure there's nothing going on, I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church, matting, seats and stone and little books, sprawlings of flowers cut for Sunday, brownish now, some brass and stuff up at the holy end, the small neat organ and a tense, musty, unignorable silence brewed God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence, move forward, run my hand around the font. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new, cleaned or restored. Someone would know, I don't. Mounting the lectern, I peruse a few hectoring large-scale verses and pronounce, "Here endeth," much more loudly than I'd meant. The echoes snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book, donate an Irish sixpence, reflect the place was not worth stopping for. Yet stop I did, in fact I often do, and always end much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for, wondering too, when churches fall completely out of use, what we shall turn them into, if we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, their parchment plate and picks in locked cases, and let the rest rent free to rain and sheep. Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? Or, after dark, will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for cancer, or on some advised night see walking a dead one? Power of some sort or other will go on in games, in riddles, seemingly at random. But superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, brambles, buttress, sky, a shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was. One of the crew that tap and jot and know what rude lofts were, some ruined bibber, randy for antique, or Christmas addict counting on a whiff of gown and bands and organ pipes and myrrh. Or will he be my representative, bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburbs scrub, because it held unspilt so long and equably what since is found only in separation, marriage and birth and death, and thoughts of these, for which was built this special shell? For though I've no idea what this accoutred, frousty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized and robed as destinies. And that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious and gravitating with it to this ground, which he once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie round. What is the poet attempting to express in this poem? Was that ever a real school examination question when I was young? Or have I been conned into believing that it was? As I remember them, my own teachers at Bromsgrove County High School, Anne Gledhill, Ken Curtis, George Lloyd, were at once too passionate and too subtle to have imposed such a locution on us. And surely you agree, attempting to express appears to presume that a poem is an act of blundering self-therapy rather than a subtle art. And no one in 2015 believes that. If you try a more sophisticated version of the question, e.g., what are the narrational and or figurative parameters of this poem, you may still be forcing the student into taking up a position she would rather avoid. If she is a potential first, she may decide to begin by challenging the terms of the question, though that requires nerve. Even I, by nature a timid, conformist, lower second if ever there was one, gained my skin of the teeth first in 1953 by telling a member of the Viva Committee that he was completely wrong about the last two stanzas of Keats's Ode to a Nightingale and demonstrating his error by effective off-the-cuff quotation. Tolkien, who chaired, was said to have observed as the door closed behind me, "I rather like the cut of that young fellow's jib." It was not, of course, a congratulatory first. One of them went in 1953 to my exact contemporary John Burrow, distinguished father of the distinguished Colin Burrow, and latterly emeritus Winterstoke Professor of English at the University of Bristol. Having given the essential period of notice to such necessary caveats, it may be allowable, still under caution, to ask what is it that Larkin is endeavouring to express or to convey or to indicate or to communicate in his poem Churchgoing. I will state the topic thus. Others may well put it more succinctly, more accurately, more justly, but I will do what I can. I think the topic is this, open quotes, "The narrator, in the course of a cycle ride, discovers an unfamiliar church and decides to enter. We observe him to be secular rather than devout. His feelings, having entered, are a familiarly elusive blend of awkwardness, interest, sympathy, and condescension, which he endeavors to analyze and assess to his and our satisfaction. Having spent some time looking at and allowing his mind to speculate on a variety of ecclesiastical objects, he leaves. So far as he and we are aware, he is now somewhat more sympathetic and a trifle less condescending." At a rough count, I make that clumsy précis of mine 91 words. I make my word count for the whole poem 473 words. So 91 words of my not wholly successful précis, 473 words of narrative and philosophical rumination in Larkin's own words. Is that ratio a gross discrepancy, that 91 to 470? Probably not. Try the same trick with one or more of the philosophical narratives among Hardy's, not among Hardy's great, but Hardy's fair to middling Wessex poems. You might get the same kind of ratio. Play the same trick, you could add, with a fair to middling example of Wordsworth's contributions to the first edition of Lyrical Ballads, 1798, and you might extrapolate a similar kind of ratio. "But when the ice our streams did fetter, oh, then how her old bones would shake. You would have said, if you had met her, 'twas a hard time for Goody Blake. Her evenings then were dull and dead, sad case it was, as you may think, for very cold to go to bed, and then for cold not sleep a wink." Goody Blake and Harry Gill, A True Story, stanza 6. "You're overtasked, good Simon Lee, give me your tool," to him I said, "and at the word right gladly he received my proffered aid. I struck, and with a single blow the tangled root I severed, at which the poor old man so long and vainly had endeavored. and tears into his eyes were brought, and thanks and praises seemed to run so fast out of his heart, I thought they never would have done. I've heard of hearts unkind, kind deeds with coldness still returning. Alas, the gratitude of men has oftener left me mourning. Simon Lee, the old huntsman, with an incident in which he was concerned, stanzas 12 to 13. Once we've finished laughing ourselves egotistically naked over such lines as "give me your tool" to him, I said, we may discover that the commingling of the narrative with the axiomatic in lyrical ballads is done with a sounder grasp of linguistic and metrical joinery than in church going, and further, that the moral summation in the final stanza of Simon Lee is more self-effacingly profound than anything in four quartets, let alone church going, to which let us now return. Or after dark will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or on some advised night see walking a dead one? Power of some sort or other will go on in games, in riddles, seemingly at random. But superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, brambles, buttress, sky. I hope that simply by reading this stanza, I make it self-evident that "but superstition, like belief, must die" is an inferior form of moralizing to, alas, "the gratitude of men has oftener left me mourning," though its tone is superior. But we're now stuck with the stanza, stanza four. Who are the dubious women? Are they what my Naylor great-grandmother might have described as no better than they ought to be? Let us consult the Oxford English Dictionary, second edition again. Dubious, 1D, of questionable or suspected character, 1860. E.g., a large bed covered with clothes of the most dubious black-brown hue. 1884, she'd been absent from England, oftentimes in very dubious company, 1893, having got into evil odour by their dubious gains. Dubious too, subjectively doubtful, wavering or fluctuating in opinion, hesitating, inclined to doubt. 1865, Miss Braddon. She raised her eyebrows with a dubious expression. 1874, I followed them, dubious as to whether I should ultimately interfere. I'm glad that we looked those things up. Larkin, in those four lines from church going, is using both senses of the word dubious simultaneously. That is to say, he is poetically employing colloquial ambiguity. He is a university wit. The reasons why Larkin is not ever regarded from the point of view of language skills as a university wit is due to a combination of causes and decisions. But how also are we to hear the line, "a few cathedrals chronically on show," almost the best single line in the poem? How are we to hear that line, "a few cathedrals chronically on show," if not as an instance of what Eliot and after him Leavis instructed us to hear as examples of the line of wit? Turn to the 1989 OED again, chronically, in a chronic manner, inveterately. Turn, as it were, infra to inveterately itself, and you find in a manner confirmed by long existence or practice, to a good degree firmly fixed or ingrained, virulently. Earliest citation, 1645, Milton, Tetrachordon. And behind chronically is chronic. Chronic one, of or relating to time, chronological, obsolete. 2A, of diseases, etc., lasting a long time, long continued, lingering, inveterate, opposed to acute in cases of illness, disease. 3, transferred sense, continuous, constant, used colloquially as a vague expression of disapproval, bad, intense, severe, objectionable. In Larkin's ruminating, a few cathedrals are chronically on show. A, because they belong, the majority of them, to ancient time, 11th to 14th centuries, and because their deans and chapters are inveterate showers off of their treasures, and because those who are hostile to Christianity deplore them as symptoms of a mental disease that has held the nation in thrall for too long, and so on, and so on. Or take pick simples for a cancer, line 30. This effective use of simples alludes to beliefs and practices of late medieval and Renaissance pharmacology. Note that we are dealing with a substantive, not an adjective, e.g. 1646, Sir Thomas Browne, from the knowledge of simples, she had a receipt, that's a recipe, to make white hair black. 1889, Augustus Jessop, the coming of the friars. Cordials were kept by the lady of the house among her simples. We have here come into violent collision with a potential nexus of readers' reactions that causes the exercise of debating poetry's place and purpose in our culture to be so fraught with resentment and weariness, though not over your cocoa, maybe. Many will object, this is too much. In describing what you, Hill, obviously consider the proper functioning of approximately 6 lines of perfectly lucid verse, you have required us to hear proclaimed a plethora of entries from your precious 1989 second edition Oxford English Dictionary in the elitist terms you generally reserve for this practice. What was it that John Keats wrote in one of his letters? If poetry comes not as naturally as the leaves to a tree, it had better not come at all. To you, Hill, a poem is not a poem unless virtually every other phrase has been placed on, then removed from an etymological treadmill, preferably too drained to stand. Well, of course Keats was correct. What we must envisage is the first great poet to whom holding 2 or more senses of a word or phrase in exquisite balance is a natural reflex, not a punishment in a 19th century literary workhouse. And what we must also envisage is the first rate reader who possesses the ability to sense with a kind of instantaneous reflex activity of her mind that she is reading a word or phrase in which 2 or more senses have a simultaneous valency. It is, to my understanding, a precise semantic equivalent of Pound's radiant node or cluster, and that only a minority of poets and readers possess this type of instinctually reflex verbal sensibility, ought not to be a cause of anger or resentment among the majority of writers and readers at the present time. But it is a source of real resentment that poems should be written with an eye and an ear to the expectation that some poets and some readers will be able to sense these interrelations in an instantaneous flash of vision, and treat it as a perfectly ordinary thing. What I'm in fact saying is that the very root and heart of the debate over contemporary poetry are profound and unreconciled and radical and drastic flaws and pressures in the nature of the society in which we live. A society in which, for a whole complex of reasons, ressentiment is the main energizing force. And a great deal of this, I think, is expended on these quarrels between what I would call the high modernists and the what I will call the postmodernists. I'm not, of course, denying that it must feel marvelous to write in such a way that you can simultaneously play a common English phrase, as you might say you both play a fish and play a phrase by Mozart or Chopin, and to read in such a way that it is like hearing how a note struck in the bass clef seems to alter slightly the articulation of two successive notes in the treble clef in a sonata or string quartet. I'll go further and suggest that the essential resonances of the English language must be maintained, if only because an oligarchical plutocracy would wish them annulled. You may say the universities are here to defend us against such incursions and encroachments and depletions, and I may answer the universities have never been averse to the benefits of oligarchical plutocracy, and now perhaps more than ever are part of it. In 1955, D.J. Enright, poet and critic, as we ritualistically say, who, circa 1939, had been a student of F.R. Leavis at Downing College, Cambridge, where, since this is my valedictory lecture, I will add that he had been a contemporary and friend of my sixth-form English teacher, Ken Curtis, about whom I've already spoken and to whom I dedicated my second book. D.J. Enright brought out a volume with the title Poets of the 1950s, an Anthology of New English Verse. It was published in Tokyo by Kenkayusha Limited. It is not that Enright had been obliged to take to the high seas in order to find a printer so insufficiently acquainted with English that these specimens of British lyrical ambition might escape censure and thereby attain desperately desired circulation. He, like numerous other British academics in the early post-war decades, was himself teaching at a Japanese university. And this anthology was a means of introducing to an audience whose proficiency in English must have been very high, because there's no glossary, the best that our island could achieve by way of verse. The poets represented were Kingsley Amis, Robert Conquest, Donald Davy, John Holloway, Elizabeth Jennings, there's now an Elizabeth Jennings Way in North Oxford, Philip Larkin, printed delightfully as Larkins on the dust jacket, John Wayne and D.J. Enright. Each poet was requested or required to provide a brief manifesto, two or three paragraphs, to introduce his or her small selection. And if the anthology remains a significant footnote for literary historians, it is because of the appearance. It's first, I believe, in Larkin's manifesto, there in that book, of a now celebrated pejorative coinage, Myth Kitty, as a guiding... What Larkin says there is, as a guiding principle, I believe that every poem must be its own soul, freshly created universe, and therefore have no belief in, quote, tradition, unquote, or a common Miss Kitty, or casual allusions in poems to other poems or poets, which last I find unpleasantly like the talk of understrappers letting you see they know the right people. A poet's only guide is his own judgment. If that is defective, his poetry will be defective, but he'd still better judge for himself than listen to anyone else. You'll be pleased to learn that I had to look up understrappers, who are, I discovered, underlings, subordinate agents, assistants, in common use from circa 1710, OED, though not where I came from. A kitty, in the sense in which Larkin is using the term in 1955, is the money placed in the center of the table in a gambling game such as poker, by extension, earnings, liquid capital, a reserve fund, a sum of money made up of contributions by people involved in a common activity, OED. I looked for Miss Kitty in my 20-volume set and couldn't find it, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. There's a vast amount of minute print in the massif of that great and indispensable work. The writing of poetry is a high-risk occupation, and gambling is a high-risk occupation. But it is bad logic to say that, therefore, poetry writing is a form of social gambling. In poker, you don't really want to get possession by chance and judgment of an ideal pattern of numerical values in pretty shapes and bright colors. You want to wipe the expression of effortless and insufferable superiority from the face of another person. You desire to possess his wife and his manservant and his maidservant and his ox and his ass. You aim to ruin him, just like in Poldark. In fact, I observe parenthetically, there are remarkably few hostile reviews these days of contemporary poetry in what used to be known as the broadsheets or even in the little magazines. Maybe about 1 in 100 reviews is hostile. But when the 100th duly appears, its intention is palpable, not to correct, but to annihilate, to render the owner of the mind bankrupt. This kind of malpractice did, of course, not derive its motus cordis from fewer than 100 words that appeared in English, albeit in a Japanese cultural context, exactly 60 years ago. The same human characteristics are discernible in previous centuries, 17th, 18th centuries, obviously. But this is too large a topic to attempt in what remains of my lecture and of my transient local celebrity. In the 1960s and 70s, the London publishing house Routledge and Kegan Paul ran a critical heritage series, and it is to this and similar publishing ventures that I would direct you. There is huge relevance for us in the exhibition of the manners and styles with which our cultural predecessors were fated or dismissed to obloquy. But the most I can hope in any way to review now is the past 60 years, not the previous 600. A Churchgoing was published in the Spectator, London, in the same year that the manifesto appeared from the press in Tokyo. I therefore find it oddly poignant when I encounter in Larkin's Churchgoing such lines as these. Or after dark will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, or dispersed yet tending to this cross of ground, or marriage and birth and death and thoughts of these, or and gravitating with it to this ground. I find it rather poignant that I should be put in mind of such other lines as these. In that open field, if you do not come too close, if you do not come too close, on a summer midnight you can hear the music of the weak pipe and the little drum, and see them dancing around the bonfire, the association of man and woman in dancing signifying matrimony, a dignified and commodious sacrament, two and two necessary conjunction, holding each other by the hand or the arm, which betokeneth concord. Or that I should also be reminded, as Eliot's certainly intended us to be in that passage, of a Tudor imagery of public polity and spiritual governance that Eliot drew into his poem East Coker with great deliberation from the writings of his collateral ancestor, Sir Thomas Eliot, circa 1490-1546, jurist, diplomat, lexicographer. If Larkin's church-going were technically better than it is, I should feel nothing but a pleasurable curiosity in treating the poems as imaginative equals and in working on from this towards an attempt seriously to assess and evaluate Larkin's own position as a politically orientated poet, to some extent in line with, but to some extent in a skewed derivation from, two poets of an older generation as related yet as distinct as Eliot, 1888-1965, and Auden, 1907-1973. I think the greatest weakness of church going is that so much of it is cast or pitched, we are speaking of grammar and syntax, in the historic present. Did he derive this also from the East Coker passage that I've just read? It may be possible successfully to pitch a prose narrative in this tense. The most recent example that I can bring to mind is Hilary Mantel's employment of it throughout the second volume, Bring Up the Bodies, of her Thomas Cromwell trilogy. You can't say that over the 5 years I haven't sweated blood, to be topical. A poem like Church Going is itself historical argument from first to last, and it seems willfully to destroy by such means as this strange historical present, a vital aspect of the dimension of thought as well as of the dimension of time. The objection, interestingly enough, originates not with me, but with Larkin's close friend Kingsley Amis. Kingsley Amis wrote to Larkin more than a year before the poem's first appearance in print, with this and other objections. These included criticism of the inverted word order in line 55, a serious house on serious earth it is, and an objection to the choice of the word blent in line 56. To my mind, there are further weaknesses, slacknesses to be found, e.g., I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek. Where the fifth, sixth, and seventh words of line 39 seem to me to exist merely to provide the correct number of syllables in the pentameter line. But they carry an implication that the poet intends us to ponder a profound existential distinction between the last and the very last. In the early to mid-50s, Neville Shute published a most depressing novel about the last remnants of humanity enduring the consequences of all-out nuclear war, some in Australia, some in an American submarine. It was later filmed. In my spasmodic reflex of irritation, and I'm going to regret this, but as the Yankee Admiral Farragut said, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. That seems to me the only context in which an author might reiterate the existential emphasis, the last and the very last, and avoid appearing emotionally and stylistically inane. Now, the critic who most forcefully expresses the objections I am here attempting to make is Charles Williams, 1886-1945, with whom I began this lecture. The unanswerable objection to church-going, a poem written some 9 years after Williams's death, the unanswerable objection. I'm prepared to pitch my claim that hyperbolically to many other English poems is that passage from Williams's Poetry at Present, 1930, which reads, "These poets have as much of our working day brains as the rest of us. Their meditations are as subtle, their philosophies no less, but no more, surely based. They remark what we do and turn it into rhythm. But the faculty of compressing such meaning into a phrase is denied to them. We have to cover as much ground in their verse as in our own thoughts, and consequently we tire as soon." This statement, which I here claim as having, if it were known to more than a dozen people, a significance for the understanding of modern English language poetry comparable with that of Occam's razor for medieval English and European philosophy, explains for me why certain of Larkin's best known, I'm trying to avoid the deplorable locution, best loved poems, Church Going, The Whitsun Weddings, and Arundel Tomb, Lines on a Young Lady's Photograph Album, are finally less impressive than others of his poems, e.g. The Explosion, magnificent poem, The Explosion, Going, Once, Water, Days, Solar, which I am prepared to hazard are considerably less well known. But there remains something to be added. Those among you who were present at the first of the three lectures delivered in the final year of my tenure, it was given in the last week of Michaelmas term 2014, may recall my saying that although Wilfrid Owen's oeuvre contained two at least of the greatest poems written in the 20th century, his celebrated preface is deplorable, and that I wish it had been left unwritten, or that having been written it had then been lost. Above all, I am not concerned with poetry. My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity. If you're really not concerned with poetry, you have no business pressing it upon the public or offering your ill-conceived and ill-expressed opinions about it. Some will say, but he didn't mean your admirable poetry, Dame Durden. He meant that awful fellow Tennyson. That's why he uses the capital P. Of course, we forgive him his pseudo-populist crassness. He was a fine poet and an immensely brave and gifted man, tormented by what he'd experienced and witnessed, and he wanted his writings to work like affidavits and testimonies and indictments, as in a court of law. The reason I remind you of what I said a few months ago is that there is something in Larkin almost as dire in its implications, although it is probably much less well known, the Owen. Larkin was in conversation with A.N. Wilson on BBC Radio 4, 29th March 1984, when he declared, "You write down things that you think are absolutely peculiar to yourself, and nobody but you would be such a fool as to invoke them or suffer them. Then you suddenly find people writing in from all over the place, saying, 'That's just what I felt, you know, man. That's it.' And so on. I find this very, very gratifying indeed. And they're quite ordinary people. They're not people who write for the weeklies." Larkin died the year after this conversation took place, and almost certainly knew during it that he was a dying man. So it behoves one to tread carefully. If the letters were from readers telling him that his poems helped them to face death with a degree of stoical courage, well, what can one say? But to the best of my recollection, his impending demise was not public knowledge. So what, you know, what were they praising him for? If it is permitted to make some general technical ethical comment that sets aside biographical implications, I would wish to say that if you find it very, very gratifying indeed when quite ordinary people, i.e. not reviewers, tell you, "That's just what I felt," I think you would be far better employed. You would be bringing far more delight to a far wider variety of audiences. You would be obtaining far greater job satisfaction if you were to sign up to appear as a regular expert on the Antiques Roadshow. Except in a very specific subgenre known by such descriptive titles as comic and curious verse, I cannot see that poetry has any obligation to cheer people up, or even to depress them in the particular ways they enjoy being depressed, which is what I suggest is what many found appealing in Larkin. In one of these lectures some time ago, I quoted a brief aperçu by the great contemporary choreographer Mark Morris. I'm not interested in self-expression, but in expressiveness. I'm not interested in self-expression, but in expressiveness. I would be entirely satisfied to have the 15 hours of these lectures reduced to that one observation, which appeared in a Guardian interview. Oxymoronically, it is the Guardian that prints at least once a week full-page advertisements for its own series of creative writing courses. Scarcely anything I've encountered in recent years more typifies the confusion of our time than the conjunction within the same Guardian format of Morris's concentrated nine-word wisdom and such advertising whose entire raison d'etre appears to, might be mistakenly assumed to, stem from the commercial incentive to profit from the desires of those who equate the power of language with the profitable afflatus of self-expression, with personal psychosexual potency and or commercial success. The origins for such advertisements are perhaps to be found in American quack medicine spreads in popular magazines of the 1870s and 1880s. Advertisements for electrical underwear to restore male potency. I saw that in one of the 1880 magazines. It's a malicious but not wholly inaccurate comparison. What matter makes my spade for tears or mirth, letting down two clay pipes into the earth? The one I smoked, the other a soldier of Blenheim, Ramillies, and Malplaquet, perhaps. The dead man's immortality lies represented lightly with my own, a yard or two nearer the living air than bones of ancients, who amazed to see Almighty God erect the mastodon, once laughed or wept in this same light of day. That's a poem called Digging by Edward Thomas, composed 21st of July 1915, and I've read it in its entirety. Thematically, it has much in common with Larkin's Churchgoing, and I cannot see that its 10 lines exclude or overlook anything to do with our mortal intellectual encounter with time that Larkin thought worthy of mention in his 63 lines. Thematically, the poems are concurrent. Sense of self enhanced by physical and metaphysical contact with that which is not self. I'm indebted to Edna Longley for her editorial collocation of this poem with Thomas's biography of the Duke of Marlborough, published shortly before this poem's composition. He, Thomas, calls the panegyrics addressed to the Duke after Ramillies verses of praise and flattery that never died because they never lived. It is, of course, a disappointment to me that Charles Williams omits Edward Thomas from Poetry at Present, 1930, while admitting the pleasing but inferior W.H. Davis, as he had omitted Rosenberg, and admitted the towering genius of Lascelles Abercrombie, as it must have seemed at the time, and which in any case was a view shared by Rosenberg. Rosenberg thought Abercrombie was a towering genius. This does not negate my recognition that Williams can reorientate in a couple of sentences the way in which we grasp how the poverty of certain highly praised poems is exposed in their narrative syntax. We have to cover as much ground in their verse as in our own thoughts, and consequently we tire as soon. I challenge you. I challenge you. Read Church Going in the light of Charles Williams's words, and still tell me that I am wrong. For 85 years, that judgment has been available, bearing the imprimatur of one of our two most revered academic presses. Yet I would be astonished if in all that time, even 85 persons had been aware of it. The tragedy from my angle of vision is that some of you who have generously attended this series of 15 lectures will suppose that one can challenge opinions, academic and journalistic, only by reference to Hillian force fields and timely quotations from Ludwig Wittgenstein. In fact, Mark Morris says it in 9 words: I'm not interested in self-expression, but in expressiveness. Charles Williams says it in 21. Then again, I'm not arguing against opinions in literature so much as against vested interests, which within our admittedly more restricted literary and academic sphere are no less virulent than those in banking or international aeronautical marketing. And now, in the immortal words of Charlie Brooker,